This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 14th of April 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 197, with me, Robert Bounds, and Sophie Grove.
On today's show, we'll be talking about the big decisions when caught in a conflict, whether to stay or go, with war reporter and author Charles Glass.
We'll also be joined by journalist Stephen Poole, whose new book takes a swipe at the airs and graces of fine dining.
And we'll be meeting Rolf Dobelli, the Swiss entrepreneur whose contact list of the world's finest minds makes him the go-to person for clear thinking.
That's all coming in the next hour, plus a look ahead at next week's news with Tom Edwards and some great music too. That's right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. You and me, how about it? It's good.
It's good.
Sunday. Sunday service has resumed.
It's fun.
I kind of like it. Have you learned anything this week, Sophie? Have you come to a great realisation about something in your life or a way of doing business? We've got a man coming on. He's the last guest on the show, but he's going to tell us how to think clearly. Maybe he should have been the first guest in hindsight or
I
foresight.
I think he should have been. I'm really looking forward to it. I can get a bit jumbly on occasions. And it's really about just making those snap decisions and not havering.
I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's never be havers.
Never haver.
Nigel brackets.
Ditherers. No, ditherers
exactly.
Be gone.
Neither a ditherer nor a git be.
and don't look back and start trying to claw back your decisions. I'm sure he's going to tell us.
I know, he's probably going to tell us this. This week, that was a leading question. This week, on Monday night, I learned something very important for, I think, my life and for the quality of some of the radio shows here in Monocle 24 and some of the editorial written in the magazine, which is if you want to have a big night out, do it on Monday. Because then it gets out of your system. No one's expecting much of you, you know, and it's fine. And that's good. And so I'm fine. So now here we are at this end of the week. I'm feeling pretty good.
Feeling good. You've basically been recovering all week.
I have. And that's a very strange thing, isn't it? To go into a week, you get it all out of your system, you rock and roll on a Monday night, which was, by the way, a very debauched and crazy art quiz. I live in Islington, my local pub. I think you've been to it. It's called the Compton Arms. It's an Arsenal pub. I've been to a pub quiz in there. It's a fairly, they're fairly raucous occasions. Nothing compares you to some of the most powerful people in the art world getting hammered at the arts club and throwing ice, throwing drinks at each other, physically brawling.
Physically brawling over some very complex existential questions on minimalism.
Exactly. And it was a fingers on the buzzers art quiz, which you should never have because everyone had a bell that sounded the same. Now you know why in quiz shows on the TV, everyone has a different sounding bell, apart from our university challenge.
They really didn't think that through.
They didn't think it through.
You should have had Jeremy Deller sort of flashing his little bulb or something. Everyone should have had somebody.
There's an idea for the Biennale. Get your little bulb out, Jeremy.
Get it out. I'm a fan of Sunday night partying.
That's even better.
Even more fun, and it is Sunday, so
we'll see you
later on.
See you. A drunken text from me later on. Excellent. We're gonna headlong into our first guest, but I'd like all our listeners to beware that Sophie's on her way out and I'm on her way in. So it's going to be a great show. Up next, we've got Tom Edwards.
It's Sunday, it's midday, live from London, this is the Monocle Weekly. And with his look ahead to the week's events, here's Tom Edwards.
Welcome to the weekly, Tom. What did you think of that intro with a bit of zoo format clapping?
I really like that. I like a round of applause. I've actually started to request that in other aspects of my life.
Yeah, just generally, like
when I go to the butchers,
when you go to Sainsbury's or something.
Yeah, Sainsbury's, they're all trained to do it.
Are they on your way out?
Yeah,
like when the Queen goes and buys.
That's right.
Some
and then as I walk out, all the different checkouts, they do a Mexican wave.
That's pretty nice.
Yeah,
it's like a guard of honor at a wedding.
Absolutely.
Or when the players walk out on the pitch at a football game,
that's right.
Has to shake everyone's hands. Thanks a lot. Thanks for coming. High fives on the way out.
It's what people have come to expect that of me now because of the fanfare with which I'm always greeted.
What's in the crystal ball this week, Tom?
I thought I'd start with something fairly literary. You're both literary types, aren't you?
Well, wow. I'm literally
silence. this week, very exciting.
They'll edit that sound. They'll make it seem like we're very clever and agreeing with
exactly. Here in London town, beginning tomorrow, the London International Book Fair.
Yeah.
Oh, one of my favourite literary events. Yeah. 3 days. It's kind of interesting to take the temperature, if you like, of the sort of global publishing business. And that's something we'll be doing perhaps all week on Monocle 24, seeing what kind of robust health it's in. I think fairly robust. But perhaps the experts will tell us otherwise.
I think so too. Because this is also, it's a book fair, but it's a publisher's fair as well. So we'll be getting lots of talk about e-readers and all that kind of jazz on there. But I think money's been made.
A lot of lunching. Publishers love to lunch.
Yeah,
I've heard there's a lot of lunching that goes on around that event. It's almost like a lunch off.
It is a lunch off. I mean, that's if you can't have a decent lunch, if you're a literary editor or if you're a publisher, if you work in the book trade, there have been straitened times for the last 10 years. If you can't have a big lunch off, what's the point?
Exactly.
What state is so
in that respect,
well, quite.
In that respect, Tom, I am a very literary type.
a long, leisurely, liquid lunch. I mean, I've already had to abandon, essentially abandoned print journalism to go to the radio in the quest for liquid lunches, which had sadly, been contracting.
It's a bit like the tagline for 2001, In Space No One Can Hear You Scream, or in Alien, rather, In Space No One Can Hear You Scream. On radio, no one can see how red your face is, Tom.
Absolutely.
So you're going to be fine.
Says ashen-faced Robert Bowne. Should we move on?
Yeah.
Midweek, Wednesday, a pretty portentous day. Syria, it's Independence Day. Right. Heavy with meaning, obviously, at this time. It's also called Evacuation Day, of course, to mark the departure of the last French troops back in 1946. And I think it will be very interesting to see whether, as we've often seen in the Arab Spring, these other uprisings, a lot of these national days, Independence Days, have seen a real sort of increase, a spike. I mean, it's hard to increase much the problems that are happening in Syria presently. Be interesting to see how that's marked by both sides, in fact, and to just sort of gauge what the sort of national sentiment is within the country as it continues to be riven by problems.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, it's one of those things, anytime there's an anniversary like this, it's always an excuse for more fighting and another excuse to kind of restate your aims, isn't it, as well?
It's funny, though, when I was in Damascus last time, a couple of years ago, you go through the souk and there are all these bullet holes in the ceiling of the souk and they're from that fight, the resistance to the French, who were there, and then they're like the pock marks of that era, and you just wonder what it looks like now, and no one really knows.
It's pretty harrowing, but I think we'll it's one to watch closely, and we'll be paying attention as ever on Monocle 24.
Okay, nice. Do you have a third arrow in your?
I've got a couple of other things. I've got a serious one, which I'll mention just briefly. On Saturday, it's the first Iraqi local elections since the majority of the US troops departed at the end of 2011. I just think this again is quite interesting because, as they've been attempting to sort of rouse interest and get candidates forwards, it's been beset by violence and problems. And even these elections have been delayed amidst all sorts of claim and counterclaim. A lot of people have suggested that Nouri al-Maliki is actually deliberately delaying them because he's of his own vested interest, this sort of thing. And I just wonder, will these elections be able to go ahead? Local elections, people sort of expressing themselves democratically. And that's one to watch very closely. A country,
so they're supposed to be happening this week.
That's right, on Saturday. Okay. So we'll perhaps look ahead during the week. Do you want to finish with a sort of final kind of cultural one, Rob?
Okay, is this a sort of and finally?
As a culture man. Well, it's quite serious.
Okay.
But it's another pleasing event. Art has been in my mind this past week. And from Friday, Art Cologne is underway. It's the world's oldest and longest running fair for 20th and 21st century fine art, as I'm sure you knew.
Yeah, it is. And Art Cologne's a funny one, actually, because it is, I don't even know how many editions it's had, but it was the first one, but it's been sort of really overtaken by Basel and some of the other ones, and even the London Art Fair in its like original incarnation. But so it's a bit of a funny one. I think they've been trying to breathe some new fire into it and make it more sceney, a more curated thing than purely about sales and stuff.
Absolutely, and it's had a kind of interesting history because obviously during the divides in Germany, it battled to try and reclaim the cultural capital, and then it's seen the influence go across to the United States, as you said, back to Europe, but to these other centres. And they're trying to sort of, refresh the look of it, refresh the lineup. They are dividing it differently. So hopefully trying to maybe reclaim some of its late 60s heyday this year.
I think that's quite a good one to go to, Art Cologne. I think that's something to watch out for. I think these are the things that are always a little bit more interesting than maybe the monoliths that we occasionally visit. Always visit, actually.
Let's hope so.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. Have a wonderful rest of your Sunday.
Thank you.
You're going out on the lash with Sophie later?
Of course not. I'm virtually teetotal.
Okay, good. That was Tom Edwards with his news roundup. Thank you very much. Thank you, Tom, and you're tuned in to The Monocle Weekly. We'll be meeting veteran journalist Charles Glass. Charles Glass is a reporter who's been at the heart of some of the biggest conflict stories of the past 40 years. Whether it was as ABC news chief for the Middle East, or picking up artillery wounds in Lebanon's civil war, or being held hostage for 2 months by Shiite captors in 1987, he's never been far away from the action. Glass has broken stories on Iraq, Somalia, Bosnia, and the list goes on.
In his new book, Deserters, he returns to the topic of conflict. But this time, Glass is taking a historical look at the US and British servicemen of the Second World War, who took the hard decision to break ranks and leave their fellow soldiers. He joins us now to tell us some of those stories and hopefully a few of his own too. Charles, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
The book is a fascinating biography, really, of so many of these different servicemen who made the decision to desert or to break ranks. Some of them are heartbreaking. Some of them are quite sort of stirring, almost amusing stories. Why did you decide to write this book?
Someone asked me if I knew anything about British and American soldiers who had deserted in the Second World War, because it's an issue in Iraq and Afghanistan, and had been in Vietnam. I said I didn't know, and I looked into it, and I discovered two things that astonished me. One, that 100,000 British and 50,000 American soldiers deserted in the Second World War, and two, that no one had ever written about it. It was a taboo subject, it was untouched, and I dug deeply and saw the possibilities for writing a good book about it.
One of those statistics, 100,000 British, 50,000 American soldiers in the Second World War, people probably, my first thought was, did they get lined up against the wall and shot? And clearly that isn't the case. I think there was only one American serviceman of that lot that actually didn't get through the court-martial intact, right?
The British had abandoned abolished the death penalty for desertion in 1930 under the first Labour government because of the revulsion at the execution of 306 British soldiers in the First World War for desertion and cowardice. The United States did not abolish the death penalty, although it had not actually used it in the First World War. All of the death sentences in the First World War in the American Army for desertion were commuted by the president. So that was intact. Only one American soldier out of the many who were convicted of desertion was actually executed. He was called Private Eddie Slovic. And his timing was probably his downfall, because he deserted during the Battle of the Hurtgen Forest, when many soldiers were deserting and there were fears that the lines would break. And then he was tried, and his review took place during the Battle of the Bulge, when things were even worse. So the military high command, including General Eisenhower, decided not to commute that sentence to make an example of him. However, in what a kind of military thinking, a resident of Joseph Heller's Catch-22, while they wanted to make him an example, they kept the execution a secret, and it didn't become public knowledge until 1954.
And delving into these stories, you tell, I think, three stories which make up the bed of the book, maybe. Did you walk into it thinking, well, this is a taboo subject, and walk out of it thinking that you've drawn some deeply psychological studies of people that have gone off and been profiteers? Some people deserted for love or found love in desertion. There are some complicated stories. It is not a man running away from the line of fire, is it?
There are almost as many reasons for desertion as there were deserters. Some simply cracked up. They had nervous breakdowns and wandered off the lines. And some of those, depending on how their commanding officers regarded them, were then given medical treatment and sent back into the lines. Others were court-martialed and sentenced to life or a bit less at hard labor. And it all depended on the commanding officer of the day and what the view he took of desertion.
Some of these commanding officers, and generals even, I mean, differed quite a lot on their view of cowardice or whether or not it really existed in battle. I wondered if they were really influential. Like, if you look at General Patton in Sicily, he seemed to be very hard, and even in his rhetoric. Do you think that, you know, Monty and all of these different generals were setting the agenda at this time?
Well, it was more to do with local commanders and company commanders, because they would have the decision on whether or not to charge an individual with court-martial, or to be court-martialed. I mean, one British general, General Sir Claude Auchinleck, in Egypt, when the British army had cracked and retreated back into Egypt from Libya, asked Churchill to restore the death penalty for desertion because 20,000 British soldiers deserted at that time during that retreat, and they were hiding in the Nile Delta and in the brothels of Alexandria. Churchill and the War Cabinet discussed it at great length, and there's voluminous correspondence about it, and decided they couldn't restore the death penalty, first because it would be very bad for troops' morale, second, it would be very bad for morale of the home front, telling people that their boys were deserting. They'd rather kept a secret. And third, and probably most importantly, they didn't want to tell the Germans that their men were deserting. And if they started executing them, the Germans would know.
I wanted to ask you, Charles, that despite the title of your book, clearly there are a ton of books about the war, about war heroes. Did you find heroism in these desertions?
Heroism, no, and I don't think any of the deserters would themselves claim that desertion was a heroic act. These were men pushed to the absolute limit. Some of them had been heroic. Most of the men that I wrote about had received battle honors. Because of the system of troop rotation during the war, only 10% of the army actually fought. Only 10% of the men were on the front lines all the time. They weren't rotated back to the rear and retrained, and replacements were integrated into their units. They were at the front all the time, and when a man died, a replacement was sent to take his place. And so this was detrimental to morale generally, because no one knew anyone in those units. I mean, if you were in, say, the 36th Infantry Division, when you started the war, there was nobody left alive from the original contingent of the 36th that landed in Italy by the time they were fighting in France.
Yeah, it's a real morale killer, I suppose, unless you're refreshing your ranks to allow men to sit there and sort of stagnate, get shell shock, as you said. This has now been renamed
post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, and this is obviously something that so many Iraq veterans, it's been in the news because so many Iraq veterans have suffered from it.
Veterans of all wars suffer from it.
Yeah, yeah.
And civilians caught in the middle of wars suffer from it. I mean, war is a very aggressive, apart from just killing people, it's very aggressive on the psyche.
Psychologically, yeah. I wanted to ask you about that, veering away from the book for a second. Obviously, the 40-year career in reporting on ABC and across the TV and for books and newspaper articles. Do you feel that the reporting of these wars has changed with technology? Do you feel that your job as a war reporter is a lot different to what it was when you started out?
It's more immediate now because you can have instant reporting of anything you see, and therefore it's less reflective and less analytical. And so I think a lot of the depth is lost because of the need for this immediate reporting. But by the same token, I suppose, at least for headlines, you're up to speed every minute of the day, but that depth is missing.
Yeah, the understanding, the deep-rooted, the knowledge of why something is happening. I guess there is a need to always be writing a new line on this news ticker, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I wanted to veer back to the book, but talk about your own personal connection with it. It's interesting that some of the characters have something in common. You know, in a way, there's a poet, there's a romantic. These people are quite impulsive, thoughtful people. Do you identify with them in any way? And do you think you would have deserted in the war? Can you identify with that impulse to just get out of there?
I can't say how I would behave because I don't know. I also know from speaking to some of them, or enter their children, that the men themselves were very brave at certain times, and that at other times they cracked. And you don't know how much you can take. I'm doing some research now on British agents in France during the war, and one of these agents, a man called George Starr, was told, "Don't worry about so and so. If the Germans capture him, he'll never crack." And Starr said, "Anyone can crack. You just don't know." He says, and the reason Starr didn't want to know the names of any of the men under his command in the resistance was so that he could never name them. He didn't know if he himself, under torture, would crack. No one knows.
Actually, one of the characters in the book you might identify with. I don't know. He Private First Class Wayne Powers, the one that he was meant to go into battle. He was very brave, but then he just met a wonderful woman on his way. way
yes,
home,
yeah,
and
him.
He ended up having seven children with her.
Right, yeah.
But actually, he was a truck driver. He wasn't in battle. He was driving his truck to the front to deliver supplies when it was hijacked by deserters. And so he went back to a village where he had met a girl, and he hid in her house. He couldn't marry her because he had no legal existence. He hid. He had six children with her towards the end of the war and the immediate aftermath of the war. But in 1958, he was found and turned over to the American MPs because the United States still had bases in France at that time. And just before he was court-martialed, 60,000 French people wrote letters to the American embassy in 2 days demanding mercy for him because he did it for love. He was convicted, sentenced, but the sentence was commuted. And he went back to the village, married her, and then they had the seventh child.
It's a great love story.
It is a great love story. There's a film in that. And there was a real Wild West thing going on behind lines.
Well, the black market in Paris was run by British, American, French, even German deserters. Mm. They had a whole underground gangland life. And there were shootouts in the streets between the deserters and the Paris police, or between the deserters and the MPs. And it was the Paris press called it a reign of terror.
Yeah, but it is amazing. This is one of the things about the book. This is why it's wonderful for this term to be given such extra definition and subtlety, isn't it?
Well, a bit. What's been more interesting to me are the letters that I've received since the book came out from people whose fathers deserted or grandfathers deserted. And it had been a deep, dark secret in the family. And it only came to light when the men were very, very old. And they were ashamed of it. But they were finally able to talk about it. There was a woman I met last night, actually, who had written to me. And in tears, she told me this was the first time she'd ever been able to admit it publicly.
And in terms of your own experience of war, it's interesting to look at the idea of morale and what motivates people to fight. I mean, a war is really defined by the commitment of its fighters, and it isn't about fear, it's about whether or not they're on side. Have you seen any situations during your reporting career where you've really sensed that dimension of people who fight for a cause?
Well, most of the soldiers whose works I read and whose letters and diaries I read were not motivated by patriotism, were not motivated by a desire to kill. They were mostly motivated by group loyalty. The platoon, the company, your fellows, they were relying on you and you were relying on them, and that's what kept them going throughout. And remember, this was a long war compared to the stints that people do in combat subsequently. And it was that camaraderie that made many people who thought of deserting not desert.
And just finally, did you find in your research and from telling the stories that you tell in the book that sometimes it's tougher to run away than it is to get shot?
Audie Murphy, who was the most decorated soldier in the American Armed Forces during the whole war, he received the Medal of Honor and Silver Stars, Bronze Stars, risked his life again and again and again during the war and didn't desert, wrote in his book To Hell and Back, "I lack the guts to take being thought a coward." So this was Audie Murphy's admission of a certain form of cowardice. And I should say, Murphy was one of the more... He worked his way up through the ranks. He began as a private and ended as a captain. When he led men in France, having fought in Italy, when a man in his unit cracked up, had a nervous breakdown, and said, "I can't fight anymore, Captain. I can't fight..." His hands were shaking. Murphy didn't slap him. Murphy didn't court-martial him. He sent him straight to a psychiatric center for treatment. Because Murphy said, "I had that feeling inside myself that I had to suppress, so I understood it."
Well, Charles Glass, thank you so much for coming in. The book is out now. It's called Desert. And, yeah, it's an honour to have such a distinguished war reporter and broadcaster on The Weekly as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
If you've ever wondered how the shirt on your back came into being, or the roof over your head, the chair you sit on, the laptop you tap on, the office you work in, the train, plane, car, boat, bicycle and lift that transport you, the phone you talk on, or even the bath that you soak in. If you want to know about the things that you live with, then tune into Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dip into the world of design. Premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, we hop from front row to back street, workshop to fairground, taking in the latest in the worlds of architecture, fashion, retail, transport, technology and graphics. If you want to know how design impacts your daily life and who the people are dedicated to making life better, then pull up a pew and tune in.
Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And we're going to be talking food next, but first, let's have a song. This is brand new from Sweden and released on James Murphy's DFA label. This is Man's Here with Outside Amore.
Put me down, place me on my whipping board.
That was Outside Amore by Swedish trio Mantir, and you're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bound, and Sophie Grove. When it comes to food here at Monocle, we're only too happy to try out something new. Thankfully, on the modern menu, it's become no longer unusual to seek out organic delicacies or enthuse about nose-to-tail dining. Just don't mention fusion.
But our next guest, the journalist and author Stephen Poole, has been looking at what our food says about us, whether it's molecular gastronomy, heritage menus, or our obsession with celebrity chefs. In his new book, Poole has decided that, in fact, we aren't what we eat. He joins us now. Stephen, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. So this book, did it come about by just one too many gastro conversations? Those, you know, incessant, those friends you have that really just take it all far too seriously.
The problem is dinner parties these days are really anxious affairs. I was touring publicity for the book in Australia, and a guy from Melbourne was saying, you know, it's terrible now because my friends cook dinner and, you know, they're really worried about having got the food right, and then we have to talk about the food we're eating all the way through dinner, and he'd rather talk about something else. So yeah, it's the obsession. I mean, the obsession with gastronomy, I think, has become a kind of infantile disorder of culture in general, and I think it's in danger of rotting our brains. And I decided to write this book especially because what really offends me is the sanctimonious nature of the foodists, as I call them, and the idea seems to be in the air that if you're not eating the right kind of organic heirloom kale, or, you know, cooking the right kind of things for 4 hours sous vide every evening, then there's something wrong with you. There's something, people are telling me there's something lacking in me because I'm not that interested in food. I like food, I like eating a bit of roast chicken, it's fine, but it doesn't consume my entire day.
Do you think that the emphasis so many TV chefs tell us that we, you know, we've become divorced from our food, and that we eat food on the fly and we eat at our desks and we kind of don't spend enough care and attention pairing dinner at home in the evenings? Do you think that's a load of bullshit? Do you think actually that we never were? That this is a sort of very middle class television chef's idea of the world in the first place?
There is this lovely fantasy of somehow sort of getting back to the land and getting back in touch with nature through food. But people, a lot of people just don't have the time. And when I was doing the research for this book, I was reading Roland Barthes, the French philosopher, was talking about canned gastronomic meals available in Paris in the 60s. So this has been around a long time. And again, the moralism, the sanctimony comes in. For example, when people realised they'd accidentally been eating horse meat when they thought they were eating Swedish meatballs, the foodists got on Twitter and said, well, A, they said, well, it serves those lower class people right for eating disgusting frozen lasagnas in the first place. And B, they said, well, the way around this is that everyone needs to go to their nice local organic butcher and talk to the butcher about the personality of the cow they're going to eat, and then everyone's fine because you know where the food's come from. But then the problem is a lot of people don't have a local organic butcher if they live in deprived areas, or even if they do, he closes at 4:30, they don't get off work till 6. A lot of people have to work 2 jobs, they get back in the evening, they're exhausted.
Those lazy butchers.
So why can't you just slam something in the microwave if you want to? I don't think there's anything morally wrong with that.
Do you think it's a particular type of person? I went to a dinner party last week, and it's an engineer friend of mine. He got a piece of roast lamb out and started injecting it with a syringe of rosemary oil. And there was a girl there who had a needle sort of phobia. She started fainting.
Who had a needle on her anyway.
She was fainting. And then it was a very strange kind of scene. You don't expect to see that at a dinner party or in a kitchen in a domestic environment. And
it's very Heston, isn't it? People love their scientific gadgets.
Exactly. Is that a type of spectacle and a type of person that really indulges in that?
Of course, it's a type of theatre. You know, you have a dinner party and you invite people out into your backyard to see the nuclear reactor you've prepared dinner with. It's, you know, it's a fashion. And Heston Blumenthal, I notice, now has his own range of spectacles at Vision Express. You can get that look of the bullet head and the enormous square glasses if you really want to, but that's the thing, he's become such a celebrity that people want that look. It's weird.
It is rather bizarre. Do you think it's a class thing as well? I mean, it's the sort of new, it's the new thing to know about it. It's about taste, it's about knowledge, it's about class. It's an upper middle class credential.
Sure,
isn't it?
It's conspicuous consumption in a very literal way. It's the equivalent of having a Gucci handbag or something. If you can show that you know what arancinis are and how they should be made, you're showing that you're more cultured, more knowledgeable about this particular subject than other people.
Yeah, and you're talking about the arancinis. This is the I think the intro to your book, isn't it? When you go to a food rave. Now, I literally hate the sound of this. I probably wouldn't mind going to something where lots of different gear is available to taste, but The idea of a food rave is pretty awful. Tell us through that sort of opening chapter.
Well, it was called the food rave, and I thought, well, this is going to be, you know, kind of back to the sort of late 80s, 90s, pounding beets and a bit of roast chicken. But in fact, it's a perfectly nice,
the 80s.
extremely middle class, you know, affair where a person opens her very nice North London flat out to people and charges entry, mind you. And then there are lots of artisanal food producers in the garden doing, you know, street food from all over the world. And I was accosted on the pavement outside by this hipster who was saying, yeah, he was feeling very superior. The arancinis aren't really spicy enough, you know. And he told me the story about how he tried to do the fashionable thing, cooking a whole lamb with the hay, because hay is really fashionable.
Well, you bury a hole in the garden and put it in there.
Yeah, but unfortunately it went wrong and there was a huge hay-based conflagration and he reduced his animal to cinders. So, you know, that was a waste of a good animal.
Yeah, and it's this idea, you were talking about that as well, the idea that they used the language of drugs and raves in the 80s to talk about food. Everyone's getting a hit of this and, right?
Yeah, a hit of this and, you know, it tastes, you know, it's like you're smoking drugs, but unfortunately it's a bit sad, isn't it, if this is what rebellious youth culture has come down to.
Having some couscous.
Yeah, exactly.
It does not live up to any of those heights.
It's not punk, is it?
No.
It's not punk.
Do you think that there is a cultural element when you go to Italy, you know, over dinner, people just talk about food? There's a kind of purity to that. And these foodies, they've taken that on, but their dialogue is all about food and they're missing, you know, what food could be about, which is, it's a social occasion, but you look beyond what's in front of you, what you're tasting.
Absolutely. I lived in France for 6 years. I lived in Paris, and a lot of French people talk about food while they're eating, but almost never about the food they're actually eating. It's about food they've eaten before or food they plan to eat in the future. But they talk about other things as well. And, you know, where my book ends up is, you know, I don't like the sanctimony and the moralism of talking about food and showing off about your food. But the whole point of food really is the social element, isn't it?
One of the things that gets me is menu writing. I can't bear, because there's always people have run to their thesauri and kind of that's the sort of new home of,
yeah,
sort of hateful food writing.
Instead of a gravy, and yeah, there's like a baby scallop on a bed of baby lettuce.
Yeah,
there's all this kind of weird sort of cutesy infantile stuff. There's a gastropub that just opened around the corner from me, and they have an amazing menu featuring, they've got wraps featuring blowtorch lettuce. Is one of those. It made me think of the chef sitting around in the kitchen one day. He said, we've got this blowtorch and we only really use it for creme brulee. And so what else can we set on fire? I know, lettuce.
Lettuce.
Charred lettuce, that's got to taste delicious.
Is it
delicious.
Possible to blowtorch lettuce? Have you tried this wrap?
I haven't actually. I haven't been brave enough to try it. They also have what they call Machiavelli eggs, which made me wonder whether the hens were particularly devious, like really Machiavellian hens who would lay an egg, but you'd never be able to find it.
That's really bad. I think there are eggs in purgatory, which is like eggs. There are eggs in purgatory, which are baked eggs, aren't they? In like a tin of tomatoes. I think they're basically getting Dante confused with Machiavelli.
It's interesting.
I think that's what's happened there.
The language of sin and religion is leaking into it, isn't it? Because, I mean, this plugs into the whole idea that food is supposed to give us our spiritual sustenance and our intellectual sustenance, as well as our actual nutrition, which I think is just a bit ambitious.
And also, people should stop taking pictures of food and then showing them to you, to one, because that's a new thing. I mean, you can't, sometimes you sit down next to someone at a dinner party and they will actually get their phone out and show pictures of meals they've cooked previously.
Oh my God, people actually do that.
What about restaurant critics? This is the restaurant critics. I mean, the Evening Standard, for them, for example, their restaurant critic Grace Dent in the Redesign magazine, she's at the front of the book. She's not at the back where restaurant critics used to be. People want to read about restaurants. People want to read amusingly about restaurants.
Yeah,
right?
Restaurant critics are kind of celebrities in their own right.
Yeah.
And, you know, people will read an amusingly written column about a restaurant if they've got no plans ever to go to that restaurant. And I will, of course, if it's entertaining writing. But it's interesting that they've become kind of the star journalists now. It's the restaurant critics and the comics that the people really want to read. Because, again, it's like, you know, people have 20 cookbooks, but they don't cook all the recipes in them. They read it as a kind of pornographic fantasy. And I think the same thing is going on when people are reading restaurant critics. Oh, well, if I went there, I'd have this kind of theatrical experience.
Yeah.
They're doing it by proxy.
I think there are many a true words spoken. The book is You Aren't What You Eat.
Fed Up With Gastro Culture.
The author is Stephen Poole. And it's just out in paperback this week,
yeah.
Okay, so we're all good to go. That's fascinating stuff. Thank you so much, Stephen.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Cheers. That was Stephen Poole serving up some food for thought.
In a moment, we'll be meeting top business mind Rolf De Belli to learn about the art of thinking clearly.
We love to champion retailers who make a point of differentiating themselves from other offerings on the high street. Our latest Monocle briefing film travels to Buenos Aires, New York, and Budapest to visit specialist shops where making is at the heart of their retail offering.
One of the big challenges with any denim brand, or any brand for that matter, is to really try and explain to the customer why it's special, why it's unique, and why it's worth investing, you know, a lot of money in a great product.
You can view handmade retailers and over 300 more films and slideshows on monocle.com.
It's Sunday, Rob, and we're all taking our time to clear our heads a bit. But our final guest is a professional at just doing that.
Swiss entrepreneur and writer Ralph Tobelli is author of The Art of Thinking Clearly, a forward thinker's Bible that's topped bestseller lists in recent years. In a career dedicated to the spread of knowledge through innovative online startups, Tobelli has also hosted a weekly show on Bloomberg TV and is the founder of Zurich Minds, a community of distinguished thinkers, including Nobel Prize winner Kurt Wirschig and renowned scholar Nassim Nicholas Taleb. Thinking caps on then, and he joins us now on the weekly. Rolf, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Despite our slightly wordy introduction, this is a book that is zeroes in, focuses in on, what is it, the instinct behind things we feel? Is that kind of the essence of it?
No, I just try to figure out how many traps are there when we try to think. And right. There are about 100 traps, 100 systematic ways of thinking wrongly.
Yeah.
And I put them together for me initially, and this turned into this major bestseller. And
So we said this has been a bestseller in German, for example, and the Spiegel bestseller list. And it's just out in English, which is why we're pouncing on it now that we can understand it.
Correct.
So there are specific familiar traps that people fall into in business, in life. Which are the areas that you're sort of focusing on?
Well, I'll focus in both areas, life and business, because it's obviously the same traps we fall into, these roughly 100 systematic cognitive errors. And systematic is a good way. It's an important word because we tend to err in one direction wrong and not in the other. So, for example, if I ask people, are you above average safe drivers or below average safe drivers, most people will say, oh, well, I'm above average safe driver. It should be about 50-50. Okay, if you ask French men, are you above average lovers in bed?
Yeah.
94% of the French men say, yes, I'm above average. Again, it should be about 50-50. So it means we tend to overestimate, we tend to overestimate our skills and our knowledge and not underestimate it. And that's what makes it systematic.
That's an interesting thing. So where does that come from? Is that a survival of the fittest instinct then to sort of sell ourselves? Where does that come from?
Yeah, it actually comes exactly from there. You know, that I'm glad you're talking about the big scheme of this. The big idea is the brain is nothing but a biological organ, just like our heart, our liver, our knee, our elbows. And they're made for a time before our time. So they're made up for, optimized for a hunter and gatherer environment. Mm-hmm. If you look at our past, 99% was spent as hunters and gatherers. These are our great, great, great parents. And only since about, 8,000 years, we have civilization, little settlements, towns, financial markets, and so on. So our brain is made for that other world, and now it's finding itself in this very complicated world, and that's why we generate these errors. Now, the overconfidence that we just looked at, mm-hmm. with these French men who overestimate their chances in bed, or tend to overestimate
our knowledge.
That's a good
example. I think we should stick with that. I like that. It's funny.
That has another origin. That has the origin of, the more I'm convinced about myself, the more I can convince others, and the more followers I have, which means it increases my status in society, which makes me as a male attract better females, and therefore I have more genes in the next generation. That's
so this goes right back to the gorilla puffing out his chest in the jungle, the lion with the thickest mane. This is all that kind of stuff.
That goes straight back to that.
Yeah.
How do you account for that sort of situation where you're in a completely intractable decision-making dilemma? You know, you have two choices and people get stuck. It's a very modern human condition. I wondered whether or not you have any solutions for that.
No, that happens to me also a lot. It happens to me a lot, and then I get outside opinions. I get people I trust. I ask them, what do you think? And even if it's a tie there, I flip a coin. Because if it really is a tie, and both alternatives are equally good or equally bad, well, you can flip a coin at no risk because whatever the coin says, it's going to be okay. You're fine.
To get to this idea of, you talked about our hunter-gatherer past. Is the book trying to encourage people to run away from that and encourage a more clear, sort of contemporary way, a human way of thinking, rather than maybe more of an animal way of thinking? Are you trying to escape that, our sort of history of doubt?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to escape, because these things are so deeply ingrained in us because of our ancestral past that we are not fit, that the brain is not fit for this world. We have created a world we don't really understand, which means we don't understand it in an emotional sense. We don't have an intuition about it. We don't have an intuition about financial markets, for example. And that's why it's important to think clearly and rational about these things. Many people just go with their first gut feeling. It's great to go with the gut feeling if you're looking for a romantic mate, or if I ask you, can I trust you, or can you trust me? These are things that have a long history. This works with the gut feeling. But trying to do something in financial markets, try to take a big career decision with gut feeling, no, that's not it.
So these are more mathematical. These are more modern, contemporary mathematical ideas that you're talking about, specifically with financial markets and things. It's like putting a bet on the races. You can go with the jockey's clothes, the silks that you like the colour of, but you should perhaps do the research of the...
Exactly.
It's going with that, right?
Exactly.
Rather than just going for the horse with a bit of your name in it.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm harking back to last week's Grand National, where Sophie and I lost badly on the horses.
We did. It was a shame. but it's quite interesting that you're looking at this kind of cognitive dilemma, but through case studies. So some of the people that you're looking at, or the kind of scenarios that you're looking at, are very sort of day-to-day decisions people make. You know, you go to the cinema, you're not enjoying it, do you leave halfway through or do you not? Do you think that those examples really, they're good to just look at how humans make decisions and you know, what type of people they are? Do they dash out, or do they sort of stay and get their money's worth? And what should you do?
Well, you know, the story with the cinema is the following. My wife and I had purchased movie tickets, cinema tickets, for €30 or £30, whatever it was. And we were on the way to the movie. We couldn't get the money back, so we paid for that online and we were on the way there. And it was a beautiful sunset, a very exceptional sunset. We live in a small little place in Switzerland, Lucerne, very, very nice little thing with a lake. And it was so beautiful, I said to my wife, why don't we just watch the sunset tonight? Much
this
better
gonna,
than going
way,
to the movies.
This is going to be an anecdote about why 97% of Swiss men are great lovers. Sorry, Rolf.
So I and my wife said, well, you know, it would be great too, but we're not just going to blow £30 for nothing. And I said, well, this is thinking error. She loves when I do that, by the way. And it really is a thinking error, because the £30 were spent anyway. Whether we go to the movies or we watch the sunset, they should have absolutely no bearing on our decision. But it often does, and it's wrong that it does. And to be aware of these situations helps us make better decisions. This is just one of those 99 fallacies.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing. It's presumably not wasting that €30 as well, your 30 Swiss francs, is to do with hunting and gathering, and you take advantage of everything.
Exactly.
You don't waste stuff, and you always make the most of whatever you have. Right?
And you don't regret it. And you don't just judge your decision by its outcome, which is one of this retrospective angst that people have. Do you try and coach people out of that in the book?
Yeah, I try to. You know, when you have an outcome, you have the outcome. So don't second guess. Try to learn at the process. Look at the process of decision making. Where did I do wrong, or where did I do fine? But don't just look at the outcome. See, if you look at the world, all we see is outcomes. Is results, but we don't see the process by which these results came about. And then if it's a good outcome, we tend to infer skills. So let's say a CEO has had a fabulous, you know, year, and the company was doing really well, or a sports star or a movie star did really well. We tend to infer skills where there are none. And it's good to look at the process by which these results came about, and not just to look at the results. It takes a lot of work to do that. The media usually doesn't do that work, because journalists don't have time to dig into the details. So it's up to you to really do that research.
And what about advice? Because when I'm making decisions, I have in the past sort of canvassed for advice. I've virtually been door knocking. But just for, you know, what do you think? You can take too much advice. And in the book, you're saying, you know, don't bow to authority. You have to find your own innate decision some way along the line. Where do you strike that balance?
Well, you know, there are experts and make predictions about things that happen in the great scheme of things, political processes or in financial markets. They make all sorts of predictions. And of course, you can listen to these experts. But the research has shown, one guy who really dug into this, he looked at 28,000 forecasts from roughly 300 experts. And all these forecasts about things that will happen in the world and countries that are going to go bust and the euro is going to crash and all these things were worse than chance, so, which means you could have flipped the coin. That's why I learned not to trust experts. Not even, of course, you don't trust experts if they have an incentive to give you a different advice. But even if guys don't have an incentive of advising you in a certain way, even those guys can't predict the world because the world is way too complex to predict. And that's why I started to not listening to experts, and they do much better with that. Rather, be yourself, think it through, and then make a decision.
You can see why you're hanging out with Nassim Taleb. I mean, do you think that his just doctrine and all of his writings, you know, the Black Swan sort of was against the tide in so many ways? Do you think that you're sort of controversialist in a way?
Yeah, I'm good friends with Nassim Taleb, and he actually said, don't publish this book because continue to write fiction. Fiction is much sexier than non-fiction books. I did it anyway, but I hang out with Nassim Taleb a lot, and I think much of that controversial, you know, way of looking at the world has to do with my friendship to Nassim. He influenced me in a big way of just looking at the world differently.
And is this the Zurich? I wanted to ask you about that actually before we finished up the Zurich Mines thing, and Kurt Wuschrich as well. How did that sort of come to pass? That collection of minds.
Yeah, well, Zurich Mines is a community of really smart people in science, but we also have a lot of smart people in the business and cultural fields. And I just realized that they are usually in their silos. The scientists are in their little labs and they only publish in their little journals. And the CEOs are in their industries and they don't talk cross-boundary other industries. And they definitely don't talk to each other. And I found that very strange, because to understand the world, we all have to share our knowledge and we have to talk to each other. So it started a couple of years ago. I rented a bar in Zurich and I invited CEOs and top scientists and top people from the cultural scene and said, why, you scientists, why don't you tell us what you research? What is the cool stuff you're doing right now in your labs? And this became such a great evening and an afternoon that people said, well, when do you do the next event? And when do you do the next event? Eventually, we needed a name for this baby, which we called Zurich Minds. And we needed to create a foundation for it. And it grew and grew and grew. And now it's become a really fascinating yearly event where we just fly in great people and talk to them. We have open discussions.
Nice. Well, that's our interview to enter Zurich Minds. Do you think we passed it? Do you think we thought clearly enough, Sophie?
Possibly. We might have been too inquisitive.
I don't know.
Confessional, even.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, before we sign off, is there one piece of advice, other than to read the book, is there one piece of advice that we should adopt for clear thinking, Rolf?
No, I think the biggest piece of advice is don't look at what makes you happier and more successful, because we don't really know what makes us more successful and happier. But we know for sure what destroys success and happiness. And focus on eliminating these things. And thinking error is also one of those categories that you can try to eliminate, and the upside will take care of itself.
Nice. Well, it's fascinating stuff. Book is The Art of Thinking Clearly. Rolf De Belli is the author. Thank you very much for joining us on The Weekly.
Thank you very much.
And there endeth the 197th lesson, according to the Monocle Weekly, Sophie. What do you think?
It was
a sermon you'd take home and print out? And
it was great. I've enjoyed our company a lot. Charles Glass was brilliant.
Charles Glass was brilliant. Do you think I went over the top and I said it was a great honour to have him on the show?
No, not at all.
He's a great man, isn't he?
He's a great man. He's an amazing writer. And it's great that he's transferring all of this sort of journalistic insight to the past. And then, you know, it was just great. Rolf De Belli. What a great guy. I mean, the book is something of a kind of dense psychological sort of tome, really, even though it's quite small.
I know, 'cause it's one of those books, I wonder whether it was kind of like a business, and it sort of is based businessmen, and I think, and all that sort of thing, and sort of hedge funders possibly, and all that sort of thing, trying to pick your way through the financial markets. But it's aimed as a kind of pop philosophy book at the same time as well. He obviously knows his stuff. And he hangs out with Nassim Hamed, the boxer.
Top crowd, yeah. Nassim Taleb.
That's it.
I think that I did sort of throw some dilemmas his way. I was going to get a sort of checklist of...
You did. I thought you'd brought some. I thought you'd brought some from home.
Yeah, I more or less did.
Some dramas.
So like, what shall I do?
What should I do about this? Let's turn the mics off. And what should I do about this? Stephen Poole, an amusing raconteur on food and food journalism.
That was a rant,
and foodism.
Let's face it.
It was a rant. But
I hugely enjoyed
it. If you're going to be ranting, be funny. That's it for 197th edition of the Monocle Weekly. Our show was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Josh Fennett. And our studio manager was Jack Phillips. We'll be here again at the same time next week, although we probably won't, will us? Us happy band of brothers and sisters.
We'll be strolling down Venice Beach,
possibly. We will indeed. Posing. I hope you've got your Venice Beach pose on there.
I already have,
Is that how you're going to do it?
I'm practicing.
But for the time being, for me and Sophie, thanks for tuning in.